Monoclonal antibody therapy of breast cancer now incorporates both trastuzumab and the anti-VEGF agent bevacizumab, and I met with Dr. Debu Tripathi to find out how he integrates these important new data sets into his practice. Dr. Tripathi began our conversation by commenting on the most recent data on cardiac toxicity with trastuzumab.
When you look at it all in aggregate, it's all very consistent. You have cardiac ejection fraction drops that are asymptomatic in somewhere between 5 and 10, maybe as high as 15% of patients, but they're of unclear significance. And then the actual clinical congestive heart failure rates are somewhere between 3 to 5%, and really 4% at most, depends on how you define it, and all the trials have defined it differently. I think it's the interpretation of the different investigators that really varies, if you ask me.
Can you talk about the BCIRG study, what the design was and what the results were that were presented?
The BCIRG study was a three-arm study, and two of them contained trastuzumab. The control arm was doxorubicin and cyclophosphamide, followed by docetaxel in conventional fashion, each given for four cycles every 3 weeks. And the experimental arms were one looking at the control arm with the addition of trastuzumab at the time docetaxel was given. And then there was a non-anthracycline arm that used docetaxel along with carboplatin and trastuzumab. And this third arm is interesting because it was designed both to avoid anthracycline cardiotoxicity and potentiation by trastuzumab, but also to follow up on some of the in vitro data that Dennis Slayman and his group has generated over the years, showing that docetaxel and carboplatin appear to be really good partners. There's synergy in preclinical models. So when it was all said and done, both of the trastuzumab-containing regimens did end up lowering the risk of recurrence. Now, there's a numerical difference between both of these arms. There's a reduction in both of them, but they're not statistically different. The reduction is numerically greater in the docetaxel and trastuzumab arm compared to the non-anthracycline arm, but longer follow-up is going to be needed to get the statistical power to really see which one wins out.
Yeah, the numbers are, I guess, about a 51% reduction with the anthracycline and a 39% with the TCH. Dr. Slayman showed the confidence intervals overlapping, and yet a lot of people are looking at those numbers saying, it looks like it's not quite as good. Is that the way you see it?
Well, yes, I must admit, I do see it that way as well. And I think the reason people see it that way is because these are very early results, and we sort of project over time how these curves may continue to diverge. However, I think we all have to be cognizant of the fact that we've been wrong about these things before, and we really have to wait for all the data to be out. But I think it's totally legitimate. I mean, after all, we have to make the best decisions we can for our patients, and sometimes as an oncologist, you have to take your intuitions about what you think might be better, even though the statistical rules don't apply. And so there's a 12% difference between the hazard reductions. And so even though that's not statistically significant, I think we need to keep that in mind.
In terms of the other side, the cardiac safety, which you talked about, there's so much data out there, I think, for clinicians, and they're all, you know, some different measurements, different ways they were evaluated. When you put it all together and you go in to talk to a patient, how would you explain it to a patient in terms of cardiac risk with an anthracycline, you know, trastuzumab approach versus a TCH or non-anthracycline approach? What would you say to a patient?
I would tell them that there is a risk of cardiac toxicity. I would probably give them a qualitative sense that there is less cardiotoxicity without an anthracycline. I'd have to give them numerical estimates of this, that it's in the 1 to 2% range for non-anthracycline, and with an anthracycline, it's going to go up to somewhere around 3 to 4%. I would also need to tell them what the meaning of all of this is, that most of them do recover. And by the way, I think I should amplify on that a little bit. The ejection fractions do recover in most patients. However, if you look at the data, especially the detailed data that was published from the NSABP safety results and the JCO, a lot of those patients are still on cardiac meds. And I think that is something to keep in mind. But nevertheless, I would tell the patient that even though it is reversible, that one has to weigh into account the risks of recurrence and make an educated risk-benefit analysis. So I think we have to give them not only a qualitative sense of the cardiac problems, but what we know quantitatively and what we know about the natural history and the resolution of these.
And I think this plays out a lot more in terms of the patient with a node-negative tumor. How do you approach those patients in terms of deciding about trastuzumab?
again, it's all about risk-benefit ratios, and I think you have to make the calculations. And you can make rough calculations, or you can go onto the websites where more detailed or perhaps accurate estimations can be made. But basically, you need to calculate what the risk of recurrence is and to what extent you're going to lower this by chemotherapy or possibly hormonal therapy, and then what the residual risk is. And at the current time, it looks as though you would take that risk and divide it in half, because the odds reduction are about 50% with all of the trastuzumab trials, and then calculate that as the benefit for the patient. And in my mind, I think that you want to see a recurrence risk that's at least 3 to 4, maybe 5% absolute difference at, say, 3 years. And that's about all the data we have now. We just don't have long follow-up. But in my mind, you at least want to beat that. And if you're in that range, then I think the benefit outweighs the risks in terms of cardiotoxicity. Now, I think you can refine that, too. We do know that there's a strong suggestion that age and baseline cardiac ejection fraction do predict the absolute risk of cardiac problems. So that needs to be factored in as well. So you really need to estimate both the risk and the benefit.
Can you talk more specifically about age in terms of what age you're talking about and what ejection fraction?
Well, these cutoffs are arbitrary, but the NSABP has a detailed breakdown by age, and they broke it down into age 50 to 60, under 50, and then 60 to 70, or really above 60. And they broke down the baseline cardiac ejection fraction from 50, which was the minimum to get in, and then different points above that, which I believe were 55 and 60. It was clear that both of those factors independently predicted the risk of cardiac toxicity. So the post-AC cardiac ejection fraction as well as the age. And the cardiac toxicity rate was getting pretty high, above 10% if you take the lower ejection fraction and the higher age group.
What about the possibility of utilizing trastuzumab monotherapy without chemotherapy? For example, an older patient where you're hesitating about giving chemotherapy.
Well, I think in theory that might be a reasonable thing to do, because the HERA study, which used all comers, did show about a 50% reduction in all groups. But keep in mind, all of these groups were chemotherapy groups. That was a requirement for the HERA study. So even though my guess would be that trastuzumab would give you a reduction, we don't have any data. And the alternate hypothesis is, of course, that trastuzumab works in the context of chemotherapy. We know there is synergy, and I just don't think we have enough information to make that extension. And I'm not against making extensions. I think sometimes when you're in a totally unknown territory and you have to make a decision, you extrapolate the data as best you can. But sometimes the extrapolations just require too much speculation, and in my opinion, this is one of those situations. So I don't think, at least at this point, that we should be using trastuzumab alone. I think it would be a good trial to do, although I would find it hard to identify what population of patients I would do it in. When you think about it, we have options for chemotherapy that are very non-toxic. And in fact, in the HERA study, there were some patients that got very non-toxic therapy. And there was a very interesting presentation by Dr. Joensuu from Finland looking at a vinorelbine-based regimen, which was vinorelbine followed by FEC. And that at least opens the door to do studies with drugs like vinorelbine, which we know has preclinical synergy and has great activity in the advanced setting. So I would very much advocate some sort of a trial, maybe with vinorelbine, and then maybe another arm could look at trastuzumab alone.
What about a taxane alone plus trastuzumab?
That, I think, is a little more reasonable, although, again, we do not have data there. Technically, the HERA study would have allowed those patients on, but I don't think there were any patients that got paclitaxel alone. However, you know, in talking about where one would draw the line, I think that that, in my mind, would be a reasonable thing to do.
What about the issue of whether to start the trastuzumab during the chemotherapy, specifically the taxane portion in an AC-type taxane approach, as opposed to afterwards? There's been confusion about that, in that you have the HERA study that used the sequential approach that showed a 50% reduction, and yet the intergroup NCCTG study showed much greater benefit when the concurrent approach was used. Can you sort of put that together?
Well, it's important to realize that the numbers at this point do not give us statistical power to really make the difference. Yes, it is true that in the NCCTG study that there was a numerically higher reduction in the risk of recurrence between sequential and concurrent. And even though that difference did meet the conventional level of statistical significance in that the p-value was less than 0.05, it was an interim analysis. And when you do an interim analysis, you generally reset the p-value to a much more stringent level. So that actually was not met in the interim analysis of the NCCTG study. So technically speaking, we cannot formally say that there is a statistical advantage of overlapping the paclitaxel with trastuzumab. Now again, in my estimation and in my projection, I do think it probably is more advantageous to give it together, and I certainly think in a higher risk patient, my preferred regimen would be doxorubicin and cyclophosphamide followed by paclitaxel given with trastuzumab. However, when you look at the HERA data, where all the chemotherapy was given later, the odds reductions are not that much different, 45% versus 50% for the American studies. So I think it's still an unknown issue. What is the importance of overlapping? My way of looking at it is that the cardiotoxicity rate, which again is not statistically different but seems to be higher with the overlap, needs to be taken into account. So I guess the extreme situation would be the very high-risk patient who's got an excellent performance status and a good cardiac function. That's someone who I would use overlapping. And then someone who maybe didn't meet those criteria, I would probably use sequential. And the sequential option opens up many regimens that you might use. For example, there are a lot of patients whose physicians, for example, like to use the docetaxel, doxorubicin, and cyclophosphamide, the TAC combination. And I think if that's your preferred regimen, then I think it could be very reasonable to use that followed by trastuzumab.
One of the most interesting things that was presented at the BCRG was the TOPO2 data. Can you go through that and then also the presentation by the NSABP on CMYC?
Yes, this is an interesting side study that was done, and in the BCIRG study, this study, of course, required that patients have HER2 amplification by FISH. Well, they also looked at topoisomerase 2 gene amplification also by FISH. And topoisomerase 2 is the target of doxorubicin, and it's been known for a long time that topoisomerase 2 amplification is associated with enhanced doxorubicin sensitivity. So in this analysis, they've analyzed about two-thirds of the patients, and there was a suggestion that in the about one-third of patients who exhibited TOPO2 amplification, that there was more sensitivity to doxorubicin, and that those patients appeared to have a better outcome in the doxorubicin arm, which contained docetaxel and trastuzumab, whereas in patients who did not exhibit topoisomerase 2 gene amplification, that the TCH and the docetaxel trastuzumab arm appeared to be equivalent. This was not statistically significant, but there was a hint that that might be the case. So I think this is a very exciting development, but I don't think it's ready for application. But the implication here would be that if you do not exhibit topoisomerase 2, that maybe doxorubicin isn't that particularly important, and you might get away with a less cardiotoxic regimen. Another study that was done on the NSABP group was also very interesting, and this was looking at amplification of the MYC gene. MYC is an oncogene, and it's been known to be involved in growth regulation, and in one of the pilot NSABP studies, this was the B28, they did an exploratory analysis of numerous genes, and they found that CMYC seemed to predict responsiveness. So then they looked at this one in the B31 data set, and to their surprise, they actually found that patients that amplified MYC had even a greater response to trastuzumab, that is, a much greater odds reduction. And it turns out that amplification of MYC may be involved in protecting cells from apoptosis, but when you remove a signal like HER2-based stimulation with trastuzumab, that then you facilitate apoptosis. So this is just speculative, of course, and I think it's too early to apply, but it is the first hint that we may actually have markers that help stratify who are the big responders and the not-so-big responders to trastuzumab, and we desperately need those. We need these for all treatments, of course, and for all of these difficult cases that are right on the borderline, perhaps these markers might help us make better decisions.
What about the issue of the delayed use of trastuzumab, the patient who has been treated a couple years ago, 6 months ago, 5 years ago, who didn't receive trastuzumab?
Well, this is really a dilemma because this is a decision that you have to make. You have to decide one way or the other. The patient comes to you and you can't just throw up your arms and say you don't know. So the way I look at this is that, again, it needs to be individualized. What we do know is that in both the HERA study and the American studies, the hazard rate in the entire population is still pretty high at years 2 and 3. It's around 10% per year. So that means that these patients are at significant risk. Now the question is, does the risk reduction still apply 2 years out? And we don't know that. The only analogy I can make is that of hormonal therapy. And I was actually quite surprised when the data on letrozole came out in patients who had been on 5 years of tamoxifen and then randomized to placebo versus letrozole, there was still about a 40% reduction. And 40% reduction is about what we expect with hormonal therapy anyway. So it looks like the odds reduction, at least in the case of hormonal therapy, is preserved, whether it's upfront or whether it's 5 years out. Now, if one extends that to trastuzumab, then one would calculate that for your average risk patient, there's still going to be an annual hazards reduction of about 5%. So maybe 10% over 2 years, maybe even more as time goes on. So in my mind, I think that we do have to realize that even 2 or 3 years out, there's an odds reduction. So again, this is where you need to tailor things. For your node negative patient that's a borderline candidate, I think I probably would use trastuzumab up front or maybe 6 months out. Once you get into 2 or 3 nodes, though, I think it's appropriate to consider it even 2 years out. And I know that's a stretch, but it is at least based on data we have on annual hazards and some extrapolations we have on the activities of other drugs when you're far out.
How about beyond 2 years, 3, 4 years?
Again, I think it's reasonable. We don't have hazard rates that far out. Right now, we have them out about as far as 3 years on the longest running study, which is the NSABP. So I think as time goes on, I would reformulate that answer. Keep in mind, every year we're going to have more data on the annual hazards. So at the current time, I would say 2, 2.5 years is my limit. But a year from now, we will have more data, and then I think we can feel comfortable. If the hazard rates start to drop, then our estimation would be that maybe people aren't going to benefit that much that far out. So it's a moving target. We just have to stay tuned.
What about the issue of dose-dense AC paclitaxel and trastuzumab?
That's a tough question. I think the theory behind it is very elegant, and the idea is that because of the growth shape of the curve, the so-called Gompertzian curve, that mathematically one postulates that giving drugs in closer proximity in a dose-dense fashion would yield in more tumor kill, and the mathematical models show this very nicely. And finally, when growth factors became available, we could actually test this. And in fact, dose-dense AC paclitaxel was better than every 3 week. However, over time, that difference has not been as great, and the survival difference is now marginal. I still think it's a superior regimen. However, the reason it's superior, I think, is unclear. One could argue that it's mostly because of the way the paclitaxel is being given. In fact, we know that in the metastatic setting and in the neoadjuvant setting that there are data that tell us that weekly is a better way to give the drug. And it may be that dose-dense is also a better way to give that drug than every 3 weeks. And that throws into question whether the AC part of it needs to be dose-dense. In fact, in the EC, epirubicin cyclophosphamide studies that have been done in Europe, dose density didn't seem to be a factor. So I think that the dose-dense regimen is a better one still. I think it's better tolerated. I think the effectiveness is better, certainly in terms of disease-free survival. I don't know that it's because of the way we give all the drugs. One could conceivably argue that maybe you can give AC every 3 weeks followed by paclitaxel weekly, which is, in fact, the way the trastuzumab trials gave it. But again, we don't have data. So my practice, because I think it's a reasonably safe regimen, certainly the toxicity is about equivalent, is to use it, I think, as a better regimen.
What about dose-dense plus trastuzumab in the HER2-positive patient?
Normally, I would say that one can make an extension on that and say, sure, why not? We know dose-dense is better. We know trastuzumab is better. But the only hook in that is that I'm concerned about cardiotoxicity. Now, granted, there was not more cardiotoxicity in dose-dense versus regular, but that was not in the context of trastuzumab. So I'd like to see some safety data, and that data should be reported shortly. The Memorial Group, under the direction of Andy Seidman, has completed this study. It's a pilot study looking at dose-dense with trastuzumab.
What do you see as the next generation of clinical trials that are going to focus on HER2-positive disease?
Well, the current thought is that we'd like to improve upon the odds reduction, and we'd like to use drugs that target other aspects of the HER2 pathway. Now, the drug that is a leading candidate is lapatinib. It's a dual HER1 and HER2 kinase that also inhibits the same target, actually, HER2, but it inhibits it in a different way. It works on the cytoplasmic kinase domain, which is part of the signaling initiator, so to speak. And there is some early data that when you combine lapatinib and trastuzumab that you may get a higher response rate. We already know that in early pilot trials, patients who are previously untreated that have HER2-positive disease have very good response rates to lapatinib. So I think it's a little too early to actually design a randomized trial. And right now, the design of the next generation clinical trials have been not finalized because of that and because of the uncertainty as to what lapatinib would add and is it ready for prime time. Now, I'm not as enthusiastic about this trend because even though I agree we need to build on where we are with trastuzumab, I'm concerned that what we're doing is just adding more and more therapies on, and we're not making an effort to find out really who needs them. And clearly, I don't want to see a trend where every adjuvant regimen involves 20 drugs. I just don't think that's the way we need to go. So in parallel, what is going on is that we are carefully analyzing tissue from the patients on the trial, and just as the topo isomerase 2 story and the MYC story is developing, we're going to hear many more stories as we start to use really powerful technology like proteomic analysis and gene array analysis to help identify who is going to benefit. And I really think you're going to see a trend, and soon too, in the individualization and using targets that actually match the individual patient's tumor profile.
What about clinical trials looking at bevacizumab plus trastuzumab?
Bevacizumab plus trastuzumab, I think, is a very reasonable combination as well. Again, with the caveats that I mentioned, I would prefer that we try to isolate in who it works. But absent that, I do think it's reasonable. There is some evidence that the HER2 pathway does activate angiogenesis. And there are also pilot studies showing that the bevacizumab plus trastuzumab combination is safe and that it is active. There are no randomized studies yet, but I think that that would be a reasonable place to look as well.
Has there been discussion about doing that in a randomized setting?
Yes, those discussions are underway already, looking at, for example, paclitaxel trastuzumab plus or minus bevacizumab.
In view of what we've seen with these four major adjuvant trials of trastuzumab, sort of backtracking to a year before that, when Aman Buzdar presented his neoadjuvant data, can you talk about those data and sort of, you know, what clues you think that gives us in terms of moving forward?
Well, the Buzdar data was a study that looked at FEC and paclitaxel plus or minus trastuzumab, and the primary endpoint of that study was actually pathologic complete response rate. And there was a dramatic increase, more than doubling of the pathologic complete response rate. It was high as 65% in the trastuzumab arm, to the point that the Data and Safety Monitoring Committee closed that study early. So a lot of people weren't even sure if it was believable. It was such a dramatic difference. But now, in retrospect, that we see that the adjuvant benefit is so dramatic, perhaps it all fits together. The way I look at neoadjuvant therapy, really, from a practical standpoint, is that, and I've always felt that in this case, we need to use the best adjuvant regimen in the neoadjuvant setting, because the most important effect of neoadjuvant therapy is, in fact, the adjuvant effect. That is the reduction in recurrence and mortality. And yes, there is the side benefit of shrinking the tumor and perhaps making the surgery easier and enhancing the rate of breast-conserving surgery. But really, the regimens we should be using in the neoadjuvant setting are those that have a proven mortality and distant recurrence risk improvement in the adjuvant setting. So I think that patients with HER2-positive tumors that are candidates for neoadjuvant therapy should in fact get a regimen such as doxorubicin cyclophosphamide followed by paclitaxel with trastuzumab.
I guess the controversial thing about the Buzdar approach was that the trastuzumab was given with an anthracycline epirubicin. Do you think that that's a strategy that we can pursue given the cardiac issues?
Yes, I think so. In fact, one of the explanations for the very high complete pathologic response rate has also been that perhaps there is really something to the anthracycline and trastuzumab synergy. I mean, we know there's synergy. We just haven't explored it because of the cardiotoxicity. And so it could be that epirubicin, which there is some evidence that in general it's a less cardiotoxic drug, that maybe there is something about the epirubicin-trastuzumab combination. In the Buzdar study, the cardiotoxicity rates were quite low. It was a small study. In the Finnish study, they compared docetaxel to vinorelbine followed by FEC, and then they also randomized the HER2-positive patients to trastuzumab or not. And in the group of patients that got trastuzumab, they gave the trastuzumab only during the initial phase, either the vinorelbine and docetaxel. However, there was presumably trastuzumab present at the time of epirubicin. They did not really see much in the way of cardiotoxicity either. So I do think this is something that needs to be explored further. The ACOSOG is going to be doing a very large neoadjuvant trial, very similar to the BuzzDAR trial. So we will have a much larger database for cardiac safety and also for efficacy in terms of complete pathologic responses. So I do think that this is a regimen that's going to need closer scrutiny, and fortunately we should have the data soon.
Is there any interest in looking at cardiac protectants and trastuzumab?
Yes, there's a couple of initiatives in that area, not only looking at cardiac protectants, but also looking at markers that may predict who's at risk, things like atrial natriuretic peptide and other markers such as those. There's also some interest in looking at polymorphisms in the HER2 receptor that might predict cardiotoxicity. There was a small pilot study that showed inherited polymorphisms in the HER2 gene, that there are certain polymorphisms that may correlate with this. And then in terms of cardioprotectants, the strategies that are being looked at are using just a less cardiotoxic anthracycline such as epirubicin or liposomal doxorubicin. Both available formulations of liposomal doxorubicin have been examined in small pilot studies and have been found to be relatively safe. So both of these strategies need to be looked at. I don't know that any of these are going to be incorporated in the near term into a large adjuvant study, but there are smaller metastatic and neoadjuvant trials planned.
You've published on the issue of continuation of trastuzumab after progression. What about the patient who receives adjuvant trastuzumab who then progresses? How do you make the decision about whether to restart trastuzumab?
I think that a patient that progresses after having received trastuzumab should definitely get trastuzumab, especially if they recurred when they were off of it. If they recur when they're on it, then I think that's a tougher question, and that's very similar to what you would do if someone progresses on trastuzumab in the metastatic setting. My personal feeling is that given the reasonably high uncontrolled response rates that have been reported in the literature, in fact, our study was one of the most conservatively reported ones because we didn't automatically get scans on everybody. So we reported at about 11% response rate in the metastatic setting with second line, but others have actually reported higher rates in the 30 to 35% range. So given that, I think that continuation of trastuzumab with another chemotherapeutic agent such as vinorelbine would be my first choice. Of course, this is an area where we desperately need clinical trials.
Let's talk a little bit about bevacizumab. The E2100 trial in the first-line metastatic setting showed an advantage to adding bevacizumab and paclitaxel.
The main endpoint, which is progression-free survival, was significantly prolonged. In fact, if you look at the hazard rates, it's a more robust improvement than we've seen, for example, with single chemo compared to doublets of chemotherapy. So I think that both the efficacy and safety really are similar. Now, there's been a lot of attention paid to the fact that the survival difference was statistically significant at ASCO, and then upon the next two presentations, both at ECHO and at San Antonio, that is no longer statistically significant. But it's really important to remember that the number of events is nowhere near what they had projected as the number of events would be to look at that analysis. So I really think that even though survival is an important endpoint, I just don't think that we have enough power to say whether or not there's a survival associated with it. Now, I do think in the end it will be important to factor in into using it. But I think right now you have to go with progression-free survival, and that's exactly the kind of conversation you need to have with the patient. Look, we don't know that this drug might make you live longer, but the evidence we have right now is that people tend to progress later on this, and that we also know that quality of life is generally affected by when you progress, and you have to trade that off against the side effects of this drug, which aren't major, but do include things like hypertension and rarely things like bleeding.
And how has that played out in your own practice as you've had that discussion with patients?
Well, I have tried to stay to the way the trial was designed, and I'm only using it in patients in first line, and I use it in patients with paclitaxel, and I tend to reserve it for patients that are either symptomatic or maybe not symptomatic, but that their trajectory of their cancer is such that I would predict they might get symptomatic soon. So it's obviously a judgment call. In terms of whether or not we might want to generalize this and combine it with other chemotherapeutic drugs, I think that's a reasonable consideration. What if patients already had a taxane in the adjuvant setting and one wants to use a drug like capecitabine? I think it would be reasonable to use it. I have not in my practice yet, or a drug like vinorelbine. Again, I think by extension it would be a reasonable thing to do. I think in a very short order of time we're going to have more data, at least phase 2 data, to help guide us in that decision. But I look at it like any other doublet. I think because it does have some side effects, I try to reserve it for patients who I think need more of a response and time of progression. That is generally symptomatic patients or, as I said, patients that either have or are going to develop visceral problems.
Can you comment on Hal Burstein's presentation of the metronomic approach with bevacizumab using cyclophosphamide and methotrexate orally?
I think that was a very interesting study. I don't think it's strong enough to affect practice at this point. This was a study based on the theory that low doses given in a continual or metronomic fashion that theoretically might target the endothelial cells and have an anti-angiogenic effect might be effective. And then now combining it with bevacizumab might even be more effective. And in fact, he did show that there was a small number of responses, too small to even continue the trial when it was given without bevacizumab. But with bevacizumab, they did see some responses. Now, I wasn't that impressed with the overall results because they really only included patients that had one prior chemotherapy. They didn't look at the kind of refractory patients that we think metronomic therapy might be good for. I mean, these patients ended up being reasonably pretreated because it turns out that many of them had had anthracyclines and taxanes, but still, they had only had one prior therapy for metastatic disease, and we have many other drugs that we use in that setting. So I think it's an intriguing idea. It certainly seems to be non-toxic, you know, the cyclophosphamide 50 a day and methotrexate 2.5 milligrams twice a day, twice a week. That seems pretty reasonable. So I think it needs further study. What I'd like to see is the metronomic approach is done in more refractory disease where we're really running out of options. Those are the kinds of patients that I think we should look at.
Would you consider using that regimen in a patient like that with late-line disease?
Yes, I have. Sometimes you're out of regimens and you think of something metronomic because they've seen everything. So you use something like VP16 or low-dose cyclophosphamide. Methotrexate's a drug that many patients have never seen and never gets used until later on. Now, I will say that metronomic therapy in earlier line is a reasonable thing if you have someone with a lot of comorbid illness. So I think one area that I might use it earlier would be in either an elderly patient that had other comorbidities or a younger patient that had, for example, some type of organ dysfunction. You have to be careful with methotrexate, of course, because you have to have normal renal function. You know, you do have to be careful with that drug, hepatic function. But still, I think that it definitely is worth exploring more. I'd like to see some correlative studies to see if, in fact, the theory behind metronomic treatment is correct. Does it affect the vasculature? We have some interesting tools now that allow us to look at this in patients, and I think it'd be nice to have some science behind this. I think we need more trials in the frontline setting, so there are trials planned with capecitabine. There was some disappointment that capecitabine in the second-line therapy was a negative study, and it was a negative study technically in that it didn't meet its first endpoint, which was progression-free survival difference. However, it did double the response rate in the independent radiology review subset of patients from about 10% to 20%. And that rate is too low, 10% to 20%, to expect that to lead to a difference in progression-free survival. So I think there is activity even in second line. So the two things we need to study in short order are other combinations with bevacizumab, and also the issue of should bevacizumab be continued after progression. Again, very similar to the Herceptin dilemma. And then it goes without saying that we need to look at this in the neoadjuvant and adjuvant setting as well, and certainly those trials are planned.
What are your thoughts about nab-paclitaxel, and what would it take for you to utilize that, for example, in combination with bevacizumab instead of paclitaxel and in other clinical settings?
I think nab-paclitaxel is a good alternative to paclitaxel. It seems to be a more active drug. I don't think we know the optimum schedule of that drug yet. It was tested in a Q3-week drug and had a little more neuropathy than standard paclitaxel, and there's been some more recent data looking at weekly schedules, and perhaps a 3-week on, 1 week off might even result in less neurotoxicity at a weekly schedule of 100 or 120 per week. So I don't think we've learned how to optimally use that drug, but I do think it is a better drug. And I think in someone that is symptomatic and you want a response, that's a better choice, quite frankly. I'm using it. And the question is now, can you extend that to combine it, say, with trastuzumab for HER2-positive patients or with Avastin? Personally, I think you probably could. But I would probably wait for the data, and that is going to be coming out, at least phase 2 data, make sure it's safe, and then ultimately phase 3 data will come out.
When you've used it in your practice, what kind of dose and schedule have you used?
I've actually used both of the tested dosing schedules. The standard 260 every 3 weeks is probably what I use more often. But I talk to patients about it, and some patients have actually been very concerned about the neurotoxicity, and I actually tend to use it at the lower dose, the 100 per meter squared weekly. I think that the response rates that were presented by Dr. Bloom in that study were on the lowish side, but it was a very heavily pretreated group of patients. And so I think that in someone whom neurotoxicity is a concern, I just go with the 100 per meter squared weekly.
How has that played out in your practice in terms of the shorter infusion time and the lack of need for premedication?
I can't comment much on my individual practice because, you know, we're fortunate in that we don't see patients with that much comorbid illness, but I think the big advantage there is that you don't have to use steroids. Of course, the shorter time is an advantage too. I mean, both of those are. But I have had patients in the past where the steroids were a big problem. Not only did they cause nuisance type side effects, but in patients with diabetes, they caused major problems. So that alone, I think, is a big advantage.
I'd like to get your take on a couple of important emerging research stories, beginning with Oncotype DX.
I think that with every meeting I see, the data there becomes more robust and more solid. And I think the number of patients in which I think I can use it and the confidence goes up stepwise, as it should for anything for all of us. We shouldn't adopt anything overnight. We should be very careful as the data comes in and expand the number of patients that we might consider it for. And I think that that's an assay that has really gathered more and more data. I have to commend that company for being persistent in bringing in new studies and reporting them at the meeting. So not only, I think, is the prognostic power more robust, but I believe that it's also going to tell us who benefits and who doesn't benefit from chemotherapy. There's data now from CMF and then also from AT combinations. So I'm looking forward to more data on that assay.
What about the recent report from ECOG 1199 comparing docetaxel and paclitaxel as adjuvant therapy?
The 1199 ECOG study was a four-arm study, really a two-by-two study comparing doxorubicin and cyclophosphamide followed by either docetaxel or paclitaxel and also by the schedule of weekly or every 3 weeks. And this is a very important study because we have been struggling to know which taxane is best, and they have different toxicity profiles. And what this study showed, in fact, is that with the data available, and I have to qualify this, that they all appear equal. And the qualification I have to make is that the target number of events was never reached. They had estimated that more patients would recur, which is a common problem in clinical trials today, is that as the outcomes of patients and perhaps mammographically detected cancers and our therapies and hormonal therapies and aromatase inhibitors have all led to fewer recurrences, we're not getting the number of events we expected, so that we don't have enough statistical power. So this analysis was done finally after 48 months of follow-up, but they fell a little short of the number of recurrences. So it didn't quite have the statistical power, but given that, all the arms were the same. There was maybe a hint that the weekly paclitaxel was better than the every 3 week, but that did not reach statistical significance. Yet the toxicities were higher with docetaxel. There was more febrile neutropenia in particular. So I think that that's an important study. I don't think it totally rules out the use of docetaxel, but I think what it tells us is that if one is going to use docetaxel, perhaps the best regimen to use is the published TAC regimen and maybe not the AC followed by docetaxel, because now we have not only the 1199 data, but we also have the NSABP-B27 long-term follow-up that shows that the addition of docetaxel, you know, gives us a trend towards improvement, but at least by the primary endpoints defined by this study is not significantly better.
What were you expecting that study to show?
I must admit, I thought that it would probably show equivalence. I think that the data we have, in my opinion, is that docetaxel is a slightly better drug, but it's better if you give it in the planned doses. And what happens is that people tend to get dose reductions. In fact, in the 1199 study, there was much more in the way of dose reduction in the docetaxel arm. So even though I do think that in the FDA-approved doses that docetaxel is a slightly more effective drug, I think that practically the way we end up using it, that it's about equivalent.
What about the issue of weekly versus Q3-week paclitaxel? I think a lot of people were expecting the weekly to be better.
Yes, I must say I was expecting it too, but the reason I didn't think it was going to end up being better in the end is that both the docetaxel and the paclitaxel would have had to have been better because this was a 2-by-2 analysis. So the statistical power was such that they would need to analyze both those arms together, and that would mean that both weekly strategies would need to be better. And it may be that paclitaxel is just a drug that's more amenable to weekly dosing in terms of superiority.